you may or may not know, from the Forest Tradition, we don't really plan our talks. We don't do too much research. Not that we're lazy or anything, but it's just the way that Ajahn Chah and the different teachers encourage the monks to kind of offer reflections, basically make their mind peaceful, and then the Dhamma flows on its own. So it's not really any kind of an academic lecture, and you're not expected to kind of memorize everything. So hopefully you're just going to set your mind peaceful, and then allows the Dhamma just to flow into your heart and your mind. And then, what you know, and hopefully it comes up when you need it. Yeah. So that's the encouragement. And so, most of the talks tend to be kind of reflections with rambling. So hopefully more reflections than rambling. We'll see. Okay, the question is then, is Buddhist Nibbana equivalent to the Garden of Eden described in the Bible? In other words, was man and woman blissful condition in the Garden of Eden without sin, perhaps similar to the blissful condition of Nibbana? And it's an interesting question, because obviously there are similarities, points to some similarities and differences between the different religions and what the goal is sometimes. And it also points to cultural conditionings that in Australia we have when we approach Buddhism. That last time, we don't approach it in a vacuum. We approach it, you know, from a certain expectations of what the Christian background brings with us. And this idea of a lot of ideas of sin and guilt, repentance, a lot of ideas about, you know, kind of the Almighty God. Is the Buddha another God that we pray to? And sometimes you see that even traditional Buddhist countries, they do kind of turn Buddha into another God, another kind of all-powerful Santa Claus that you pray to when you want something. You want a husband, you want business to go better, you want your kids to behave, you want a new car, a better job, you go pray to the Buddha. And sometimes in Buddhism you see that as well. It's called the Justice Buddhist. They just go to the temple, wave a few justics, make a wish, and then go back home. Totally ignoring what the Buddha, you know, taught, not knowing who the Buddha is and what his message was, or what his teachings were. And hopefully, and that's what one of the good things is being a Buddhist in Australia. You don't, a lot of that stuff can be re-examined. A lot of the culture of Buddhism can be re-examined to see, you know, what did the Buddha actually taught? And how can we kind of put into practice and understand Buddhism from a practice point of view? Yeah. So to begin with, there are many differences and similarities and differences between Christianity and Buddhism. And I guess, you know, if you're looking as Buddhists, you know, whether we are kind of conscious or not, there's an aspiration, or whether we know what it's about, there's an aspiration for Nibbana, whatever that is. Yeah. It sounds like a nice idea, like a heavenly realm that you go to, hang out with the Buddhas, as some of the sects believe, you know, you repeat his name long enough, he comes down and plucks you up from the earth just before you die, just before you pass out. You go up and you kind of hang out with all the Buddhas in the past. It sounds like a nice idea. How does that really work? I think, you know, from my own kind of approach, my own conditioning, my own teachings as a Buddhist monk in the Forest Tradition is, you know, there's many ways to approach Buddhism. But one of the more useful way, I think, is that, you know, it's the Buddha or Buddhism is not so much as an idea, it's not so much as kind of another in religion. But really, what the Buddha left behind was an educational system, right? He left some things behind for us to kind of first understand, and then to put into practice, and then to realize for yourself what he realized, right? So like I said, you know, and it's while the practice and the message can be inspiring, it doesn't really work unless we start to do something about it. We start to train our mind. We start to practice in body, speech, and mind to purify that. And then eventually, you know, seeing the peace, and the compassion that flows from the practice, and to taste that ourselves. So it's not just about, you know, an idea, what to believe in, what do Buddhists believe in, what does Christians believe in. That's not so important as, you know, whether you put into practice these instructions that the Buddha left behind, or that his Arahant disciples left behind. And that's the wonderful, you know, thing about kind of myself and when belonging to a living tradition, the Thai Forest tradition. You can meet, you know, monks and nuns in Thailand who, you know, I have faith in, that I kind of have deep realization from their practice, who just sense, you know, very peaceful, kind, compassionate beings that you don't normally see anywhere else. And that's one of the things that gave me faith in the Buddhist teaching to begin with. And that's the thing. You know, some people think of Nibbana, you know, it's because we were kind of brought up, some of us were brought up in the Christian kind of conditioning, saying that, you know, Nibbana is another heavenly realm that you experience bliss all the time. Get your favorite food, you don't have to do anything, just kind of hang out, listen to heavenly music, and that's kind of happiness. But from a Buddhist perspective, that's almost impossibility. There's nothing, there's no realm, there's no dimension, there's no place in the whole universe that is not subject to laws of change. And you think about logically, you know, you go to a place, you listen to the same beautiful music day in and day out, it becomes boring. Get your favorite food day in and day out, that becomes very boring. You hang out with the same people, that becomes boring. So, you know, for Buddhism, Nibbana is not this heavenly realm where, you know, you get happy all the time. Because with happiness, the social economy, there is suffering that comes along. Right? You can't have that one without the other. What Nibbana is actually, and this is hard to get your head around, obviously the Buddha says, you know, unless you become fully enlightened, you really don't know what Nibbana is. But certainly there's enough clues he left behind to point where the direction is. And in Buddhism, peace, stillness, is the highest happiness. And sometimes if you don't practice meditation, or you don't come across the Buddhist teaching, then you don't really get an idea in your head around peace. That's really boring. And that's why people go on holiday, because they get bored staying at home all the time. But as you practice, you know, you realize that, wow, not having to do things, not having to go places, not having your sense, you know, your sense kind of basis excited. That's really peaceful. That's really happiness. Buddhism is not about having things. It's about allowing things to fade away, about the disappearance of things. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, you kind of condition in the worldly ways. You bring all that kind of extra baggage also to Buddhism. You know, when you meditate, you want things to happen, you want your jhanas, you want the bliss, you want all sorts of different things to fill your mind, you want the visions of heaven or hell, and visions of ghosts and, you know, devas or whatever. And you wonder why the mind is not peaceful, right? Remember, and sometimes, you know, people come and it's a fairly common complaint I get from the monastery. It's like, yeah, it's a really nice place, Ajahn, but aren't you bored? Nothing happens here. You have your meal in the morning, then there's a long, long afternoon, nothing happens. Then there's evening chanting. And it happens day in and day out. It's like, oh, every day. Meals at 10, sit at the same places. Different people come and offer food, and then nothing happens. And they get really bored after a while, and they want to move to different places. But I was trying to encourage people, the boredom is actually the entryway to peace. It's when the mind, things start to disappear and people are not used to it. Because in the world, you're used to stimulation. You know, live life to the most. Extreme sport, extreme everything, extreme makeover, extreme this, extreme that. Because you're bored with normal stuff. Nothing can be normal anymore. It has to be fabulously exciting, or else we don't want it. Right? The newest next thing, iPhone, the newest whatever, Samsung, the newest bit, holiday. The news, job, places, houses. And it's a constant stirring up, constant of wanting to get things. And that's a lot of time causes distraction, causes more suffering. Then we realize we buy into always wanting things to happen, wanting things. And the thing with meditation, Buddhism, is that after a while you get the feel of actually allowing things to fade away. Not exciting, not having the new thing, not having to see new places all the time, not having new relationships all the time, not having new experiences all the time. That itself is quite peaceful. That itself leads to calmness and clarity. And that's one of the paradoxes I realized when I started to practice Buddhism, was that before in the monastery, I worked in the finance industry, and there's a fair amount of traveling going on. And of course, when you travel, on the company, it's great. They give you a company credit card, you can go wherever you want, go to nice restaurants, nice hotels, go to different cities, and it's kind of exciting for a while. But if the mind was calm, clear, after all things are the same. Whether you're in London, Paris, Tokyo, same restaurants, same fish food, fish or chicken, whatever you eat, it's all the same. Same music because of globalization. Every club you go to has roughly the same music. And everything looked kind of gray because my mind was kind of tired and distracted. And the thing I found very interesting was that the year I spent in Thailand, in this Thai monastery, very regulated. You gotta wake up really early in the morning, go to alms round, have your meal, do a bit of chores, go in the afternoon, a bit of chanting, a bit of sitting, evening you rest. But it's the same kind of very regulated, very structured environment, and nothing really happens. But I found that as my mind becomes more calm, that things begin to kind of calm down, that I found that the world around me, the same monastery, became just like such an interesting place to be, because everything changes. Every day you walk in arms around, the sensation of your feet on the ground is always different. Sometimes the ground is soft, sometimes a bit harder, if there's rain, walking on wet earth, sensation is very different than walking on a dry ground. Different birds are singing every day, the way the sun shines on the different kind of the ground, it's always different. And when the mind became more calm and clear, you notice so much more around your environment. And then when you start to look inward, you see your different states of mind that comes up. That's also incredibly fascinating, how your reaction changes from day to day. You basically have the same food, you sit next to the same people, because of the way our hierarchy work. You don't get to choose where you sit, like, oh, I'll sit with my friend over there. I don't like this person, I'm gonna sit over there tomorrow. Then they work that way, where you like them or love them, and you hate them, you gotta sit where you sit. And it allows you, because you can't change, that it kind of forces you, encourages you to really look into your own reactions to the world around you. So many of us look, we were happy, we think it's always bringing us happiness. Oh, my wife is wonderful, my husband's really great, we get along so well. And then when we get annoyed, it's like, oh, my wife is the first thing. Oh, I've got such a bad karma. I'm stuck with this person. What do I do? How do I get rid of this person? Yeah, get a divorce. Get somebody else. And we always think that happiness and suffering is something out there that is causing us this thing. But so much of Buddhism, so much of the practice, is really regarding our relating to how we look at things, how we relate to things. That so much of the world, happiness or suffering, is what we make of it. Yeah, there are unpleasant people, there are unpleasant situations, but a lot of time we add so much to it. It's the the commentary inside, the whinging, the judging. They're not wanting to make peace. They're wanting to accept things that causes so much suffering. So after a while, when you have a clear mind, you kind of look inward. You say, oh, okay. This mind of ours is very tricky. Like the Buddha, the Ajahn Thun says over again, your mind, your emotions are not you. These things come and go. The mind is something behind that. It's kind of the watcher. And you're not your emotions. And when your minds become more clear, when things are calmed down, like a quiet place, like a monastery or a meditation center, you get more of a glimpse of how quickly the mind changes. And it's not you. You're something beyond that. Yeah, so your moods and emotions come and go, and you watch it, you don't buy into it, and you're happy, you know, happiness is great, but that changes. And when you're suffering, you have pain in your knees, and you know, you feel annoyed with the monasteries, or with the teacher, or with the teaching, or with the food, you also know that's also impermanent. It also changes every day, and you see that clearly. Some days, you know, as the abbot of the monastery, you get it all the time. Some day when people are happy, and they come to you, and say, Janice, thank you so much for having me. This is the best place in the whole world. I'm so happy to be here. And then a week later, when they get bored, when knee starts to hurt, then they start coming, no, you're doing this wrong, you're doing that wrong. Why can't we sit less? Why do we have to show up to these morning meetings? You know, I get better meditation at home. Well, I can meditate whenever I feel like it. Yeah, you're not, you can't speak any Thai. Why can't you speak any Thai? You're Thai first tradition. They start to fall fine with everything. And you're like, you know, when people praise you, it's got very little to do what's happening in myself. And when they blame you, you look inside, it's got very little. People in a good mood, they say wonderful things. In a bad mood, they start to criticize. And then you don't take it so seriously. Praise and blame. Different emotional states of the mind that comes and go. You see that, and you watch. And that's why as you sustain your practice, that, you know, sometimes I try to warn people, you know, you go into a monastery, sure, you know, it's the peaceful environment, really good people, because everybody's, you know, trying their best to cultivate peace and kindness. And initially, the mind will calm down, this will be beautiful. But other times, when your mind starts to calm down, other unresolved issues that you've kind of covered over, you're not focused on, that starts to come up again. And then people get very scared. You know, I'm Buddhist, I should love everybody, I should never have a mean thought about my parents. Always, you know, accept people, have a lot of gratitude, and then you have all these kind of dark thoughts that comes up from time to time. Okay, that's the nature of the mind. You can't have all pleasant thoughts. That's an impossibility. But then we, for some reason, you know, because we're a practitioner, we think that's the only thing you should have. And then we get very scared, very distraught, very embarrassed, very kind of guilty when kind of unkind thoughts about other people, judging about other people that comes up. Then we think, I'm a Buddhist, I shouldn't have these thoughts. Then we suppress them. And they go away for a little. But then they're still there and they come up. So that's why they say, you know, kind of meditation, it's the purification of the mind. When you practice, you see these kind of thoughts that you have. But you try to watch them. You step back, you say, okay, it's not a great thought. But you kind of bring the teaching of the Buddha into your mind, says, you know, not me, not mine. These thoughts come and go. Okay, you're trying to kind of incline the mind towards wholesome states of mind. But also no knowing, unless you are fully enlightened, unwholesome states of mind will come from time to time. Right? The idea is just to learn from them, to see what the cause is, why they come, and how long they stay. But not to take it personal, not to feel guilty, not to get depressed over them, but to watch things. And then after a while, you have more confidence. You have more faith in the Buddha's teaching. Because when you apply these things, they work. And that's the beauty of the Dhamma. We don't have to sell it. We don't have to advertise. We don't have to do it on TV. When you start to apply the teaching of the Buddha, it's amazing how well these things work, how much more calm you can be. What you attach to is suffering, you realize, I'm being attached to them. You drop it, the mind is peaceful. Someone says something to you, criticize you. You know, before you practice, you didn't know, you start to think, why is that person saying that? You know, saying mean things to me. I've been very good to this person. I helped them where I could. And yes, they never thanked me. And they're talking behind my back. They're saying these terrible things. And you hold on to these things. And then you get, unhappy. You suffer for weeks and weeks at a time. And then ever so often you remember the words of the Buddha. Not to hold on to the past. Whatever people say to you, that's their karma. I am responsible for what I do with my mind. I'm not going to think about this. Thinking about unpleasant things, thinking about things that make me annoyed, unhappy, I can drop it. What people say or do, that's their business. But our mind, what we do to our mind, that's what we're responsible for. Someone calls you stupid, ugly, bad hairdo, split second. And then you remember for months and months and months. So the bad karma is, you have to be clear where the karma starts, huh? The bad karma is that person calling you, you know, names. That's only a split second. But when you remember and you keep reliving those things, that you're making that bad karma. That's your bad karma that you're reliving, remembering, and, you know, bringing up other negative things into your life. That's the bad karma that you're making in the mind that you're not aware of sometimes. Yeah? So as you practice, the mind become more clear. It's like, I'm not going to think this way. I'm going to not going to remember this. I'm going to, you know, steer my mind towards something more wholesome, inspiring. Or just kind of accepting the truth. People say nice things, and they say rotten things. No big deal. Yeah? And that's why you say the word, you know, letting go, acceptance, over and over again. Sometimes it can be overused, but they work. And a lot of time is that your kind of your responsibility in terms of practicing is trying to bring the teaching of the Buddha, trying to bring the teachings of the great monks and nuns into your practice in ways that's relevant, in ways that you can relate to. Yeah. So don't be kind of reluctant to experiment, to change into your practice, and to kind of see things in a way that makes sense to you. Yeah. And it's great that the BSV has many teachers and many traditions that come and teach, providing many perspectives onto the Dhamma. And so that's not why, that's not, you know, you see different monks and nuns, different role models, that you can kind of get a better idea. You know, enlightenment is, you know, we all have a kind of perspective on it, perspective on the teaching of the Dhamma. And for each and one of you to do is that, you know, to see what works for yourself. To always, you know, modify, to change, to always make the Dhamma something live. Yeah. Because sometimes I go to, you know, kind of traditional Buddhist houses, and this beautiful, you know, teaching of the Buddha, the Tripitaka, beautiful kind of Buddha Rupa, but it's all behind glass doors. They never open it. They just bow to it every day. Now, the teaching of the Buddha is for you to read and to practice. Bowing is nice, but it's just the beginning, not the end of the practice, right? Bowing, paying respect is good, but the ultimate, the highest respect you can offer to the Buddha, the ultimate respect you can offer to your teacher out of gratitude, is really to put their teaching into practice. Yeah? To realize for yourself what these great arhats are talking about. And that's the highest respect. So yeah, it's good to bow, it's good to offer flowers to the shrine, it's good to look after the shrine. But knowing that it's, you know, it's the beginning. You know, just kind of contemplate, you know, what these flowers mean. Purity, peace, kindness, what the Buddha Rupa, Buddha statue represents. Peace, kindness, and compassion. So the more we bow to that, the more we incline our mind towards that. So hopefully it starts things rolling. Yeah? So it's not just something, an empty ritual that we do to get over with. So try to kind of bring all the ritual Buddhism, try to make them meaningful. Try to bring the teaching of the Buddha into your life. On a day-to-day basis, you're very busy. You can't meditate a lot. You know, like Ajahn Dunn was saying, just 3 to 5 minutes, just to calm the mind. That's all you need to do. You don't have that. You can't do that. Then, you know, how about keeping the five precepts as best as you can? Yeah, there's always something you can do. There's always something you can practice. Yeah, but no matter where you are, what stage you are in your practice or in your life. Be very busy with lots of kids, looking after the young kids, full family. Practice kindness and compassion. So like I said, you know, Ajahn Dunn is always great on, you know, the baramis, the spiritual perfections, the spiritual qualities. Whether you're at home, young, old, in a monastery as a monk, always things, always spiritual qualities that you can practice. So instead of kind of focusing on nibbana, it's like a goal, a destination, a place that you want to get to or be there. You practice on the things that will get you there. And those things are, you know, the spiritual qualities of, you know, kindness, compassion, patience, generosity, wisdom, truthfulness, determination, equanimity. So there's always wholesome qualities. And then when they ripen, they become, you know, to fruition, and they become, and then you'll see for, you'll know for yourself what the Buddha's talking about. You know for yourself, like Ajahn Dunn was saying. When you practice, it's just like eating. You know, you eat one spoon at a time, And then as your belly becomes more full, eventually you know you're full. Nobody can tell you that you're full. Nobody tells you, you know, how much you should eat. Only each and every one of us know for ourselves how many spoonfuls it takes to know when we're full. And that's what the practice is about. You know, because kind of always inclined towards, sila, samadhi, panya, harmlessness, ethical conduct, stilling the mind, practicing meditation, and then cultivating wisdom while contemplating the Buddhist teaching of impermanent suffering and not self. And then as you do it over and over again, sometimes looking at the body, examine it, is this me or is it mine? Can you control your body? Can you make it, you know, as it gets older, can you make it young again? As it, you know, starts to become sick, can you tell it to become well again? Yeah, so things, basic things that you can practice each and every moment when you're sick. Say, yeah, instead of kind of whinging on, why am I sick? Oh, I should go to, what doctor should I go to? Should I try a different type of medicine and get obsessing over a different kind of treatment? You can try to bring the Dhamma into, you know, the situation. Sickness is normal. There's nobody here that doesn't get sick from time to time. Growing old is normal. So what's the best way to kind of relate to the situation? What's the best way to do? What's the best thing to do? It's, you know, to look after the mind. You look after the body in whatever way you think is appropriate, and then just watch the mind. Once you're not carried away, obsessing about the different details of medical treatment or different things that can go wrong, try and stay in the present moment, you know, make the body comfortable, as healthy as you can, and then focus on the mind. Yeah, because sometimes, you know, in the West we get overly obsessed with health things, organic stuff, and there's, every year there's a new thing that you should be taking. You know, and for different type of trace minerals and different types of supplements that's going to make you feel really good and you're going to live another 20 years. And then, you know, there's always a new thing. But remember, the mind is also very strong. If you have a happy, calm mind, it does a lot to add to the health. I'm not saying there's no health benefit to supplement, there is. But sometimes, you know, the anxiety, the obsessing over, oh, I'm missing my multivitamins, and no, I'm not going to feel well now. I've got to get this and get, I've got to get this kind of food or that kind of food, or have my kind of water, special water that I get, and, you know, I can't drink tap water, and this is all poison, whatever. The anxiety is around not having your, you know, perfect food. You have to pay attention to that. That also does something to the body about it. So, you know, kind of, yeah, take care of your body as best as you can, but also look after the mind. And also ask yourself, you know, how am I feeling today? We're always constantly obsessing about, yeah, okay, I'm fine, good, you know, whatever, I'm not healthy. And then, but we don't look at the mind. How am I? Are you kind of wrecked with worriedness? Are you anxious, nervous, excited, distracted? So, you know, kind of take care of the mind. You know, put in that kind of nice zone of kind of peace, stillness, happy, grateful for all the things you have, instead of looking for all the things that's missing in your life. Yeah, you can look for things. And that's one of the things, you know, bringing back to kind of similarities between Christianity and Buddhism, is that, you know, I tried to kind of, my mother is Catholic, very staunch Catholic, and I'm going to visit, try to visit my family once a year in May. So we come back, and of course, every time we go back, my mom goes to churches every day. So I go to church at once, just to, you know, catch up with the church lady, say hi, and also trying to steer my mother towards a bit of practice. And I don't dare talk about Buddhism in any way, because she said, no, I'm going to go to hell, don't do that. But I tried to steer towards the Dhamma in a way that, you know, in practice, mom, it's good to practice, to pray to God, to ask for the well-being of, you know, different people, to pray for their well-being, all that's good. But also, from time to time, maybe you can also, you know, give thanks to God for all the things that you have already, instead of always asking for new things. Like, you know, you have lots of things, you know, good health. Okay, health is not perfect, but good enough. You know, you've got, you know, good family or whatever. So bring things that you can be grateful for. So that way it steers your mind towards, you know, kind of a bit of calmness, a bit of stillness. Because when you are grateful for things, you're not looking for more things. But when you go with the mind of, you know, even very pure intention of praying for world peace, praying for, you know, famines to end and, you know, justice or whatever, it still points to a bit of fault finding that, you know, the world is great, but we can fix this, fix that, fix other stuff. And it brings to a bit of fault finding, a bit of negativity in the mind. And you have to be careful. So the same. So in the morning or at night, before you go to bed, think about three things that you can be grateful for. Think of three things that are going right in your life. It's always looking for, you know, something's wrong or something to improve on, you know. I'm healthy, but you know, I can be more healthy. I can be, you know, do more stuff. Yeah, that's endless. And that's not going to lead to happiness. A bit of gratitude leads to contentment. And contentment is a beautiful kind of stillness. Because when you're content, you don't have to do anything. If you're, you know, you want to change things, then it takes, you have to do things. You have to get involved, manage things. But you're happy with the way things are. And it's great. You don't have to do anything. You can be still, be peaceful. You can rest in the present moment. Yeah. So as you look around your life, look at the world, look in your own mind. You know, bring up things that you can be grateful for. Bring up things that are going right in the world from time to time. Because remember, when the Buddha became enlightened, his world wasn't perfect. There was war, famines, injustice, rape, pillage, all sorts of, you know, terrible things. But he still became enlightened, and he still can teach, and did a lot of good. And that's the power of truth, power of Dhamma. 2,600 years later, in a completely different land, we're still practicing what the Buddha taught. And that's an amazing privilege, amazing thing to reflect on. And yeah, we're so different in certain ways, the time of the Buddha. And yet we can still practice and still realize peace that he's talking about. Yeah. So that's kind of the aim of Buddhism. It's Nibbana, it's a state of, you know, equipoise, state of calmness, but state of, you know, complete contentment. That, yeah, and, you know, I'm going to borrow a story from Ajahn Brahm. Some of you probably have heard already. Since we're talking about Nibbana and the Garden of Eden. So this is a story of the wishing game. Five kids, four boys and one girl, right? And they play this wishing game. Whoever makes the best wish wins the game. So first one comes, first one's already saying, what do you wish for? Wish for an ice cream, because it's a hot day. Wish for ice cream, fair enough. Second boy's like, that's easy, raise his hand. I can beat that, how do you beat that? I wish for an ice cream factory. So I have my ice cream every day, whenever I feel like it, three times a day, my ice cream factory. Okay, so it's like, then third boy thinks of it, raise his hand, I can beat that. I wish for $1 billion. I can buy my ice cream factory, buy my toy factory, buy anything I wanted for $1 billion, right? I can be happy forever and ever because I can buy whatever I want, right? And that's what most people, whether they realize or not, aim for a vast amount of wealth to do whatever they want, to please whatever desires they have, whatever comes to their mind, you can buy. I mean, how happy is that? Really, until you see these rich people, they're not really happy, but never mind. These billionaires that, you know, they have wherever they want, so we think, but they're not really happy either. But anyways, $1 billion sounds pretty good. How are you going to beat that? Buy whatever you want in wealth. Right, so the fourth kid said, I know what I want. I want three wishes. First wish, ice cream I can have right away. Second wish, $1 billion, buy whatever I want. And third wish, I wish to have three more wishes. So that's an unlimited amount of wish, right? You're sick, I wish to be well again. When you're getting sick, you're getting, I wish to be young again. Right? So you can do whatever you want, unlimited amount of fish, wish. Does that bring happiness? Is that the best one? But there's a little girl. She's very quiet. She thinks, and she raises her hand. She says, I can beat that. How can you beat an unlimited amount of wish? Right? Get whatever you want by wishing. To be young, to always be happy. That's what we all aspire to. Right? To get whatever we wish for sometimes. We think happiness is getting what I want. Annihilate all the people I don't like. Now I'm putting them off the face of the earth. Move them to a different planet. I just have all my friends around me, all the people I like. Right? That's what the power, we think that happiness is about. But the girl, possibly a future Buddha, she says, my wish is that I wish I was so happy and content. I don't now never need a wish in my life. So that is the future Buddha. That is enlightenment, right? So you're so happy and content that you don't need a wish. Whatever you have, you're so happy. You don't think of anything else, what's outside of your spirit. Yeah? And that's what it points to the way where Nibbana is. It's not about having more things. Even not having your jhanas, not having the blissful state, not having the bright, beautiful mind, not having love, those can come naturally. But Nibbana is kind of ability just to stay in the present moment, to be happy, to be still, not moving. Because once you start to practice meditation, you see any movement of the mind, that's suffering. Whether it's positive or negative, it doesn't matter, it's suffering to move, to hold on to anything. Yeah? So Nibbana is this kind of letting go, complete peace in the present moment. So I leave that for your reflection this Sunday morning. And may you all achieve complete boringness in your practice. Nothing ever happens. Okay. Any questions or comments? One question?
It wasn't conditioned, but we all actually are conditioned, because really the Buddha's practice can only be appreciated when one has reached some maturity in a conditioned life. Is that kind of, I think that is kind of right, because I often think about how thoughts come up, you think from nowhere, although we know they're not from anywhere, and how I'm conditioned in a certain way, Christian certainly, and with my own parents who were particular people who created particular issues.
So,
we all really have to come from the conditioned position, don't we?
We are, and that's why sometimes it gets a bit paradoxical when you think about it, because the mind is unconditional. Well, how can unconditional thing come from a conditioned things?
And I guess that's kind of the paradox I was alluding to.
I think the thing is not to, with the practice of, and looking inward, your own state of mind, our own kind of set of social conditionings, parents are made who we are, to understand and then to make peace with that. You're not trying to be a different person or a better person. You're just being the person that you are, knowing that you have certain preferences because who you're born with, where you're at.
Exactly.
Yeah, and not to kind of change yourself. Some people have this mistaken perception when they go into practice to change yourself to be a better person. I'm angry. I should be more loving. No, you can. Once you see anger for what it is, mind lets go automatically.
Let go.
Yeah. So it's not more you're getting that doing more things. It's more of making peace and allowing things to fade away. And that's the wonderful thing about the practice. Once the mind sees clearly where it is making a problem, it lets go automatically. So you don't have to do anything. You just have to see clearly with wisdom, things let go. If you are attaching because you haven't seen clearly, but that's okay. A lot of acceptance help goes a long way. Knowing that if you're not fully enlightened, you get angry, depressed, jealous, annoyed from time to time. And that's okay. That's okay. Yeah, it's just learning about it, learning about your situation, learning who you are. What makes who you are, instead of trying to, I want to be that person. Oh, she's so beautiful. She sits all the time, so peaceful. Sits in full lotus. Oh, one day I'll be there. It's not about that. It's about just, learning about yourself.
Understand
yourself. And then things will develop. The mind will open up by itself. We're kind of tied up, attached to a certain identity, who we are, what we think we are. And we're so much more than that. And just allowing the mind just to open up. Yeah, so you're not who you think you are. That's the main thing. Yes?
I'm just wondering, if you're thankful for everything that you already have, what drives you to do, a change, to do something better? For example, you say, you can practice 5%, and then after you are comfortable with all the 5%, what drives you to do another thing? Because you're already like competing in your state.
The mind becomes more still. Things become more. So you're driving because you want to get to a certain place, but in each present moment, there are options and there are things that you can incline towards. So this different things open, different doors close. And if you're in the present moment, you get a feel for it. So you don't have a picture where you want to be, or where what thing you should cultivate. But you know that you want to move towards wholesome states of mind. You want to move away from unwholesome state of mind. That's the main thing. But it's sometimes thinking about the practice makes it complicated. It's true. If you're so content, why are you bother practicing? So sure, in the beginning there's a bit of movement, but just know that it's more of a gentle nudge than a bit too much willpower. Sometimes people kind of see their practice with a lot of approach their practice anyway with a lot of willpower. And they come, I'm so angry, Ajahn, I don't want to be angry, I want to be loving. And then just calm down, relax, and then once you see the anger for what it is, the mind will let go. But like when you're angry, instead of saying, I shouldn't be angry, well, you're adding more to the problem because you're thinking more about it. But you feel the anger in the body. So it just feels anger, and it's not pleasant. So the more you know about anger as it arises in your mind, the mind will let go. Yeah? So that's the practice more like that, of kind of a slight nudge towards wholesome state of mind. Yeah, sure, in the beginning there's obviously some discontent to propel you, the suffering of the life, the irritation in the body, to propel you towards the practice, or just a yearning to be a better person. Sure, that will help. But if you take that, you grasp on it too tightly, then that causes a lot of restlessness and suffering, because you're never good enough, right? In the beginning, you still find, oh, I should sit 10 minutes. So you're kind of punishing yourself. Oh, I should sit half an hour. Oh, I should sit an hour. Oh, it's not lady next to me, sit 4 hours. Oh, I better sit more. So if it's constant like that, then it's suffering. But you just approach it, I want to be a bit more peaceful, a bit more kind, and learn about myself. You'll find that will bring more joy and happiness. Yeah, more peace and contentment. As contentment grows, the mind becomes more clear. And you see more clearly, get a better feel for where the practice is heading. Yeah. So it's true. I mean, you think about it, yeah. If you're completely content, you wouldn't be here, right? You wouldn't be at home, in bed. You won't get out of bed, because you're so content. Does that help?
Still confusing, but...
And that's the thing. It's just kind of put into practice, and then you'll kind of feel for yourself, yeah. Is that something you can think your way through? Certainly not Nirvana. Yeah. Yes.
I was wondering how important the jhanas are in talking about peace and happiness.
The jhana is very, very important, but then it's the double-edged sword, because the more you talk about it, the more craving arises. And when you crave, you cannot have jhana through craving. So that's a bit tricky. So that's why, you don't talk about, I don't going to be so technical or specific in terms of jhana, but just cultivate peaceful state of mind. Mm. Yeah. And then whatever that is, and also cultivate this kind of attitude of always learning about your meditation. Because sometimes you have jhana as a goal. It only comes, for some people once every 5 years. So everything else outside of that, 4 years and 363 days, it's just a waste of time. You think, oh, I only got 2 hours, and that's the only jhana, and everything else is a waste of time. But it's not how it works. Jhana comes, some people get it more often, other people don't, other people never get it. But you just meditate just to be peaceful, meditate just to learn about yourself and your state of mind. And that's a much more beautiful way. But you meditate just to get jhana, a lot of suffering involved. 99.9% of the time, you're not going to be in jhana. And you think, oh, I'm going to waste another 2 hours. I'm sitting there thinking, when am I going to get my jhana? When am I going to get jhana? I get my refund from Ajahn Ram. I put my $400 in 9-10 days, and I still don't get my jhana, Ajahn. Yeah, so just meditate to be more peaceful and to learn about yourself, to be present. Yeah, that's more useful. And then you might even get your jhana when you're so peaceful.
What is the difference between during the state of jhana, you don't have feeling of self. like a depersonalized feeling, and through wisdom, insight, even for a moment you don't have see a separate self. What is the difference between the jhana practice, some of the practice you get that feeling, and through vipassana practice you develop through wisdom, even for a momentary sense of, no sense of separate self?
I think any jhanas or any deep samadhi state, it just adds a lot of power to the mind, very bright, and you're more still, so you see things more clearly. And if you don't have that stillness, the mind moves all the time. Then it's very hard to kind of reflect on anything too deeply. If the mind is still, you can hold a concept, a thought of, suffering, where is this body? And it stays there, starts to reflect on different ways that we attach to the body and see clearly what the body point is. But the mind is not so still. Then you do that for a couple of seconds and something else comes up, forget. And it never really sinks in. It never really teaches the mind that the body is one thing, the mind is another. Yeah. So that's why jhanas or deep samadhi helps, kind of the reflecting on the truth and it finds to make the truth, leaves a deeper impression on the Dhamma. But in jhana, it's not like you can reflect. You reflect after you come out of jhana. Yeah. But it also in jhana, because of utter stillness, then the sense of self disappears. There's no thinking. So much of our thinking and feeling comes from, a sense of self grows from that. There's a bodily feeling, and we think, I'm feeling pain. But it's just, feeling comes and goes. We put the I into that. But with a deep stillness, samadhi state, nothing happening, no I. So you can see more clearly when you reflect on, this feeling of, me doing things, it's not really there. So I must not be there. Yeah, I must be making these up. And we're making a sense of self out habit. You walk around, I'm walking around. I'm Joe or Blow or whatever, but it's just a body and mind. Things come and go. Yeah.
How much of wisdom one should have to sort of understand that?
There's many paths, and sometimes you need a little stillness, and you have a lot of wisdom. You just need a little stillness, and you see clearly. Other people can be having jhanas all the time, and still no wisdom. They're just So it varies, and depends on your characteristics. Yeah, and then you just work for yourself. You have a little peace. Reflect on nature of suffering. What is happiness? What is happening? What is really suffering? What is Ajahn talks about? What the Buddha talks about? What is Nibbana? We just reflect on it. The mind still, it just stays in that theme for a long, long time. It bears deeper and deeper, deeper into certain things you think about. But the mind's not still, oh, Nibbana is highest happiness. Oh yeah, I remember that. And you just go on to another thought. Yeah? So that as you become more still, things become more clear. But sometimes you have a very sharp wisdom, like Sariputta, you don't need a very still mind. You can just reflect and you understand the truth. So it varies until, all the lifetimes of the practice you've been done until now. Yeah. But as long as you use what you have, you don't need to, have a perfect samadhi to know. You don't need perfect wisdom. Just arouse as much samadhi and as much reflection as you can.